Yes, we heard a number of concepts mooted yesterday. You will hear them again today. You'll hear them again in a few minutes. I've been asked to speak to the title, A Common Goods Understanding of Europe's Future. I'll do my best with that. But to start off with, let me pick out, therefore, certain of these concepts from the conference brochure. And you'll understand my particular focus, I hope, in a minute, even when I refer to the Vatican press release of 2 days ago. With a particular focus on strengthening the value basis of Europe, we're engaged in applied reflection and policy assessment of the cultural and value basis for intercultural dialogue, which I will link directly to decision-making. And I'll be arguing that there's a model there in the European Union for decision-making with intercultural dialogue. Seen from an internal and external perspective, I try to highlight both of those aspects. And looking at the perspectives of a value-oriented Europe in the world, therefore, is an intimate part of that. How we appear to the world, what contribution the Union can make to the world directly through a contribution to the evolution of the new international legal order in particular, offering perhaps its model to the global level. I could nuance that, of course. We're not saying we have the framework, join us, become members of the European Union. That's not what is being said. But we have certain elements and instruments which have achieved intercultural dialogue in Europe, have been shown to work, and they might be used at global level, is my argument. Imagining Europe's future as a plural entity, of course, a socio-economic model shaped by a community of shared values, I indicate some problems with that, and Europe's role and responsibility in a plural and globalizing world, and I'll also say something about that, our responsibility. Vatican's release, a press release on a report issued by the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, where the Vatican argues that politics, which is responsible for the common good, must be given primacy over the economy and finance. And existing multinational institutions like the IMF, could go on and name them all, have not been responding adequately to global economic problems, but it's not just the economic problems. This release focuses on that. Cardinal Turkson, the president of the council, said, "The time has come to conceive of institutions with universal competence, now that vital goods shared by the entire human family are at stake, goods which the individual states cannot promote and protect by themselves. That is what pushed us. And then, to function correctly, the economy needs ethics, and not just of any kind, but one that is people-centered." Ideas from yesterday, from Luke Burkhardt yesterday as well. "The report is highly critical of an economic liberalism that spurns rules and controls and fuels social injustice, both in Europe and outside Europe. Perhaps primarily outside Europe. It must become more representative and with greater levels of participation and legitimacy. We should also set to achieve free and stable markets regulated by an appropriate legal framework and working towards sustainable development. So international institutions must become more representative, must be regulated by an appropriate, to achieve free and stable markets which are regulated by an appropriate legal framework and working towards sustainable development and progress for everyone." Now, some ideas. A common goods understanding of Europe's future. I start in this way. The common good context. We are aware of the social doctrine of the Church. We're aware of definitions going back in time to the ancient Greeks as to common good, etc. I'm not going to try and define the common good, but if anything, I'm going to try and ask the question, or begin to answer the question, how? But the common good, that's my starting point, is this: the common good is a function of space, time, and form. So it will mean something different depending on the circumstances and especially on the level at which the decider is deciding, if you like, or the dialogue is happening. So we can think of a local definition or perspective on the common good. We can think of a regional common good as perception of a common good. Think of an international or global perception of the common good. And our aim is to arrive at that mediated, if you like, global perception of the common good, where we're all working towards that, understand what that is, and then are implementing at the various levels. Now, how do we achieve that? The treaties, looking at the EU for the moment, through the objectives and aims, claim to embody the European common good, so the European level, from the perspective of all member states as a whole, and for the pursuit of these values, values, of course, linked to democracy, rule of law, solidarity, but also development, sustainable development, economic progress, etc., and in the context of the deeper values of the Union, for the pursuit of these values, also in Europe, but also in its external relations. The European Union is to contribute to the development of international law. Now, the question which I will ask is whether the European Union is therefore an international protection regime, or at least in part an international protection regime, in the sense in which certain international relations scholars use the term, such as Bruce Cronin, for example, in his book Institutions for the Common Good from 2003. Basic values, though, can't be taken for granted. We have realized this. We have unrest in Europe as a result directly of the financial crisis. We're in a state of shock. We're questioning our values, and we should be. However, we know we need to get through this period also with an eye and a focus indeed on global peace and stability in a globalized world, and looking to the interests of future generations as well. And we increasingly claim that these values of ours, which would lead us through, indicate the way to the common good, not only for us, but for the peoples of the world. This is what we claim. This common destiny project is something we sometimes try to engage in on our terms alone, but it's not possible to engage in this exercise only on our terms. So, next idea is there are levels, therefore, of the common good, and possibly overlapping circles of these perceptions of the common good, so the local, the regional, the global. Now, what matters is how, therefore, each level acts. And the idea here is that, ideally, in an ideal world, each level will fully take into account the perception of the global good at every other level. This is the key idea. So when deciding locally, we have to look regionally and globally. When deciding globally, most importantly, assuming we can set up the institutions to do this, the global level must look regionally and locally as well, must take into account the perceptions of their common good at that level. This calls for the principle of solidarity to be applied in full. It also presupposes the creation of mechanisms for the transmission of the perception to each other level, and that, therefore, is a challenge which the European model perhaps can help us imagine, as we are imagining not only Europe, but the world. So, the assumption is that each level starts off from its own interests, its own sense of the common good. That is an oversimplification. It is not the case at the moment, certainly not in Europe, and that's the way Europe works. But we need to work at that. So, the basis for action for the common good is my next my first conclusion, let's put it this way, is that we point out that there's a problem with assuming that the common good, as defined and pursued at any level, will always encompass the common good as perceived at any other level, that is an assumption we cannot afford to make. Unless this decision-making is structured so as in such a way as to bridge the gap, that's my first conclusion. That means that we need to mediate as between perceptions of the common good at different levels. I'd like to take two practical examples because just quickly because we're trying to be practical also. A recent proposal, and this may be a bit technical for some, but a recent proposal to come up with a common consolidated corporate tax base. Now that has created enormous difficulties for member states' economies are divided as to, if you like, an emphasis on manufacturing and sales on the consumer side with large consumer populations. Others, the smaller ones, Luxembourg, Malta, tend to be based on services and on intangibles. The criterion for deciding where taxation would take place, as proposed here, the criteria exclude intangibles, so that the basis for deciding which jurisdiction has the power to tax that entity would depend on the fixed assets of that entity, where the employees are, and where the consumers are. Now that would destroy a couple of European Union economies at a blow. But the proposal has been made by the Commission. Presumably it's in the common good, in the idea of the Commission. At the local level, in Malta, Luxembourg, and some other countries, it's diametrically contrary to the perception of the good, of the common good at that level. In other words, at the level of Malta or Luxembourg or some other countries. The principle of subsidiarity has been invoked. It's been argued that there's no competence at union level. These are the kind of debates that we have juridically, if you like. But that's an example of a question being raised even today as to whether, in fact, we have this mediation at union level. We could argue it's the institution's job to do the mediation, but it's a fundamental attack here on a lower level perception of the common good. So this is an example. Another example, migration. With migration, and this is a slightly different tack. In the post-Stockholm scenario, the EU is planning to put in place a common migration policy, a common asylum policy. Is there an obligation upon the European Union and all of us in the EU to pursue the wider common good, the good of all men and women as individuals, human dignity? So we talked about human rights. Is there a responsibility upon the European Union to do that? Has the European Union shown that it is willing and able to do this? There's been lots of criticism. The big issue is, do we really deeply think and act on the basis that for us to ignore the plight of others when we are in a position to assist would diminish us? And this is a concept that, of course, came up yesterday as well. In other words, showing solidarity with others not only furthers the common good, the good of others, but also our own common good. Now, do we see the human rights of others as our responsibility to that degree? There's been lots of criticism from, say, the European Parliament. We don't need Frontex on the question of the internal agreement on Frontex now. We don't need Frontex. What we need is a humanized refugee policy, more in tune with our values. Marie-Christine Vergel, we do not want this Europe, this fortress Europe, that gives lessons on human rights and is unable to reach out and help refugees. The Greens, half-hearted improvements on human rights protection fall short, they say. So, when operating on the wider stage, is our heart really in it, is the question. The same with the proposal on foreign workers, creating inequality within Europe itself and on workers posted from one member state to another. There are judgments of the Court of Justice that seem to accept that there can be inequalities within Europe itself. My point, this type of approach endangers the, as was said by AEDH, this type of approach endangers the principle of equal treatment and social cohesion in Europe, but it does more, as we heard yesterday as well. It erodes our very souls. And these are serious charges They beg the question whether the EU sees its mandate from its members and citizens in purely utilitarian terms, or whether the EU can regard itself also as an institution for the common good, in the wider terms in which our own treaties and also in which new thinking in international relations points. But our treaties too, heard yesterday, Article 3, Article 21, I want to read that. Next question. Is the European Union, are our governments free to pursue this common good, mediated common good, if you like? Are they free to do it? Do we leave them free to do it? Are we all conspirators, if you like? The economic crisis has shown that we can be short-termist as the next man or woman. We need to, conclusion three, what must be the answer is that assuming the wider common good demands a different approach, what must be the answer is for the higher level to assist and show solidarity with those states who will otherwise be guided by short-term but real concerns, selfish but real concerns. And that applies also to the European Union. We may be tempted to be guided by short-term selfish concerns in the absence of institutions at the global level being called for by the Vatican, as I said also, which do not properly take into account the perceptions of common good. And that's solidarity again. Conclusion three, I go on. What this indicates is that there must be guarantees that the good pursued at the higher levels, and equally importantly, the manner in which it should be pursued through dialogue, proper democracy and representation, actually will be for the good of all, without unreasonable or uncompensated detriment to any individually perceived good at a particular level. And that's, if I may recall, the first example I gave of the proposal for a common consolidated corporate tax base. What we have seen in recent times through the Arab Spring also is that if we ever thought that the Libyan people did not share our values, I think we've seen that they do. It was easy to block our minds off from the people and deal with the governments, if you like, in an intergovernmental context, but as civil society rears its head, then we have come to realize that we share values. What principles, therefore, should guide all this? The answer, I think, is democratic consent. We assisted the Libyan people, despite possibly obstacles from international law itself. What explained our ability in that context to be positive now about what we do as Europe, ability to act? What explained it and legitimated it was the consent of the Libyan people, not the legitimate authorities, for a while still the legitimate authorities, but we recognize new authorities and then we listen to the Libyan people. So, there is hope there in terms of looking at shared values across what previously we thought were divides. Clearly, mechanisms for mediating the common good are necessary. Institutions are necessary, as the Vatican has pointed out too. The need for institutions is clear. What kind of institutions? I think we can again look at the EU model. Certainly, supranationalism is a key concept. Supranationalism, majoritarian decision-making, with full representation and full solidarity. So, I think those are the key ingredients. If decisions made at the global level by global institutions properly conceived are to be legitimate and the rule of law is to prevail. Proposals based on pursuit of the common good at that level should pass through the filters of the camera lens in order that the picture of the common good be clearly brought into focus. Any proposals made with the view of the common good, the global common good, should be tested, as they are in the EU, should be tested against the filters of subsidiarity and proportionality. Second, they should be tested against the principle of solidarity, both procedural and substantive. solidarity, so that any higher level of common good, any global common good, will not be pursued at the unfair or unjust expense of any lower level common good, as perceived at that lower level. And thirdly, it should be forged, proposals should be forged in democratic exchange and in full dialogue with full respect to cultures and values, and this is perhaps the most problematic part at the global level. I'll skip what I was going to say about common goods. There are all sorts of ideas being bandied about. Malta's papers, I think, for through Arvin Pardo using Malta, if you like, at United Nations level, for proposing the concept of a common heritage of mankind. There are many goods, as the Vatican has said. Now, I'll let that speak for me, I think, though I need to read it. The goods which should be taken outside the ownership, not only national level, but also global level. The concept of ownership should be replaced by the concept of mandate or trust. And that's another argument. But there's very much that could be said on that. I have to leave it there. 3 minutes. So, institutions for the highest level common good. Now, this concept in international relations means a specific thing. And the question is the European Union an institution for the common good? Well, the test is, these institutions should help advance the broader goals of an international order by helping to maintain a preferred social or political framework through which states can cooperate and compete on the international stage. So the key idea is that such, let's call them organizations, so institutions at global level, the European Union, have a function beyond pursuing the common good as the sum of or distillation of the national interests of the members, as put forward by their governments, whether these interests cover the long term as well as the short term. An institution for the common good will have, parallel to that aim, also the aim of creating, and this is self-interest too, creating the international environment which can also preserve long-term its values and its particular identity. The European Union surely it wishes to be seen as such an organization. So I would argue that this kind of thinking is directly relevant to the modern-day EU, especially after Lisbon. And we have to drive forward from our own European but also Western-oriented perceptions. We have to drive beyond this to dialogue properly in order to see these international institutions and this framework come into being. Conclusion number 6, while preserving all the major gains in terms of European and international orders that have been made over the last 200 years, the European Union, its members, must be prepared to be big enough, even as only one player among several strong players, to see past its own, especially short-term interests. We should be prepared to go beyond. Else, how can we be a credible player on the global scene? We cannot demand better conduct from others than we do ourselves. So my final conclusion, the challenge for the EU post-Lisbon is to make the European Union work as envisaged by Lisbon. And my conclusion is that it boils down to us by offering our vast experience in intercultural dialogue with supranational decision-making to help create at global level true institutions